to the political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Welcome, everybody, to another live installment of the Political Cesspool radio program. It's Saturday evening, August 7th, as we broadcast to you live once again from AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, going out to the AM-FM affiliate stations of the Liberty News Radio Network as we simulcast online at thepoliticalcesspool.org and libertynewsradio.com. I am your host, James Edwards, and here we are once again with my co-host, Keith Alexander. Keith, another show, but a new month as we now march forward into August, the year rolling right along.
Onward and upward, James. You know, we were talking before the show tonight, and it really is great to be on this show. I think we both look forward to it every week. We have gotten through this show to not only read, but to meet and greet and know and become friends with some of the best minds, most intelligent people alive in the world today. And I mean that seriously. People like Edmund Conley, Steve Saylor, Jared Taylor, Gordon Baum. You know, we could just go on and on. William Lind, Paul Craig Roberts, you know, one after another. And quite frankly, this show has been the catalyst. We have brought these minds together and given them a platform to get their ideas out to the public, and we've gotten to know them in the process. And it's been a great deal, I tell you. We're still kind of pinching ourselves, asking ourselves whether or not it's for real or not. But it's great, and we love it.
Well, if it's a dream, Keith, I certainly never want to wake up and another one of those leading lights who use our vaunted
platform, or
vaunted radio program as a platform is Hutton Gibson. Hutton Gibson, who made his debut appearance on our show back on January 9th, will make an encore appearance tonight. Hutton Gibson, our featured guest this evening, he'll be coming up a little bit later in the second hour, and we look forward to continuing our discussion with him. It's been a good day for me. I started off a little hot, though. I was outside mowing the grass, thought I was going to have a heat stroke, so I had to come in here, cool down with a little bit of that southern sweet tea, and I've been listening to some music here in the office as I prepared for the show tonight. Of course, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons were on the, you know, in the CD player. That goes without saying, but I was also listening to a little bit of the Beach Boys, a little Sloop John B. Keith up there right now, and Johnny Rivers, the Everly Brothers. They were all Dion, they were all singing for me today, getting me in a real high energy and positive mood as we bring you tonight's installment. And we're going to start off this evening with an update on the Tea Parties. We covered the Tea Parties so often on this show for the last year and a half, at least.
So promising and yet at the same time so disappointing.
Well, that's right. And we've gone back and forth. We've tried to be as objective as possible, comparing and contrasting on that proverbial balance their potential versus the mistakes that they've made. And this past Saturday, a week ago today actually, was the date of the much ballyhooed Unity Rally. And that's spelled UNITEA, Unity, as they would spell it in the hood. That was held in Philadelphia last week. Now, it was supposed to be this big showcase for the Tea Party movement to show how wildly popular it is with black people. The rally logo said it's for all communities, which means, of course, for all non-white groups. And of the 14 speakers, 9 of them were black. Organizers had been promoting it for months, and they really started hitting it hard after a prominent figure in the Tea Party movement sent out that letter from Abe Lincoln, parody of about blacks. Now, supposedly this Unity rally was going to prove once and for all that black people love the ideas of conservatism, and they were going to shame the liberals into silence about the Tea Party being a lily right movement. Now, how did it actually come off? It was a massive failure, of course. About 500 people showed up, and out of those 500, about a dozen of them were black.
And nine of those are up on the dais, on the platform speaking.
Right. And what did the speakers babble about all day? Well, they went on and on about the Tea Party, how the Tea Party isn't racist, declaring over and over that they're not racist. And
you know, if you're black and you go to a Tea Party event and you're not asked to go up on the speaker's platform, you ought to be pissed, because just about every black face that goes to a Tea Party movement immediately is thrust to the top of the speakers list. It's incredible the pandering that goes on. And again, as this Unity situation shows, it's all for naught. You don't get any credit. You don't get any black support. And that's because black people realize that limited government is against their interests, just like lower taxes are against their interests. They want your tax money so it can be redistributed to them. They want big government because big government is exactly the mechanism that stacks the deck in their favor through affirmative action and government coercion against white people and white organizations. This is how they've gotten to where they are.
Well, I'll say it again, and I'll say it as clearly as I can, as slowly as I can, so everybody can understand the message. Every Tea Partier in America needs to read my book, and I mean ASAP, if it's not too late already. And it very well may be. In my opinion, if you read our blog at thepoliticalcesspool.org, you'll know it. I have gone ahead and called it, Keith. I have declared the Tea Party movement officially dead. And the final straw for me was Alan Keyes. When you're reaching out to Alan Keyes for validation, you've really hit rock bottom. Alan Keyes coming to the Tea Party Express's rescue. Tea Party Express was this Tea Party group that had sent out that parody that kind of stoked the flames of the Tea Party being a racist movement. Well, so now this very group who issued something that was very truthful and quite funny are now reaching out to Alan Keyes for their salvation to prove that they're not racist. And quickly here, I'll read this and turn it back over to Keith for further commentary. The Tea Party movement's Not Racist Week continues with a national black conservative rally in Washington on behalf of the group. Nearly everyone in the movement agrees went too far on the issue of race. The Tea Party Express. Now I'm reading here from, these are the words of the Talking Points memo. These aren't my words. But the bottom line is, this group that did nothing wrong, but it, of course, is getting skewered as being racist by the lamestream media. They have done as far too many people do. They've fallen on their sword. They're apologizing. They're groveling. And they're reaching out to Alan Keyes to save them from being called a name. And again, if they had read my book, they would understand that there is no venom to that name. You just got to disregard it and move forward. But of course, we're talking about the R word here. And Alan Keyes was going to absolve them of the sins, their racist sins. Well, Keith, tell them all they need to know about Alan Keyes.
Well, what this whole story shows, James, is that genuine black conservatives are as scarce as hen's teeth. And, you know, calling Alan Keyes into the rescue is probably the worst idea ever. Alan Keyes is responsible for the ascendancy of Barack Obama to the U.S. presidency. If you'll recall, back in 2006, I believe it was, or maybe 2004, there was a senatorial race for a U.S. Senate position in the state of Illinois. The white Republican candidate was a fellow named Jack Ryan, R-Y-A-N. Typical Rockefeller Republican type, big tort reform guy, went to Dartmouth, was Phi Beta Kappa, seemed to have all the credentials, including a pretty wife. Well, unfortunately, that pretty wife filed a divorce, and in their divorce papers, there were some incidents about some type of sexual scandal came to light. So the Republican Party dropped their white candidate like a hot potato, and they decided that they were going to teach the people of Illinois and the United States a lesson. Again, fearful of being labeled racist, they recruited a carpetbagger named Alan Keyes from Maryland to be their candidate to run against Barack Obama. Alan Keyes, of course, is a black man, too. Now, Alan Keyes, we were all assured, was a rock-rib conservative, somebody that you could really put your money on and you'd never be disappointed. Well, he moves to Illinois, starts campaigning, and what's the first big topic out of his mouth? He assures all of the good Republicans there that he is 100% behind reparations for slavery. And, of course, by doing that, he turned off all of the grassroots support that he could have had. He made the most embarrassing showing of any senatorial race that year. He got less than 25% of the votes, made Obama look like a Superman, and basically vaulted Obama in the Democratic political party of hierarchy into the leading candidate for president. And now we have a anti-white racist slash socialist as the president of the United States because of Alan Keyes and the idiocy of the Republican National Committee.
But, of course, not learning anything from that lesson and the numerous lessons that are similar to that, the Tea Party movement continues to go down a path littered with failure. The Unity rally and the recruitment of Alan Keyes to be one of the national spokesmen, just two of the latest examples of why I believe the Tea Party movement could be on its last legs. We're going to take a break and move on to other topics. We'll be back right after this. James Edwards and Keith Alexander here on the Political Cesspool Radio Program.
When the truth is found to be.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the political cesspool, everyone. James Edwards here, hosting with Keith Alexander this first hour. Bill Rowland will be joining me during the second hour as we interview Hutton Gibson, father of Mel Gibson. Going to be talking about issues related to Christianity and the faith of our fathers. Hutton Gibson has dedicated his life to defending the faith of our fathers, and we'll hear from him as he makes his second appearance on our award-winning broadcast in just a little bit. Now, Keith and I were covering a couple of disturbing stories pertaining to the Tea Parties there in our opening segment tonight. And when you're covering stories of, such a disheartening nature, you've got to kind of dig deep to lift yourself up out of those doldrums, Keith. And why don't you share with the audience how we do that during the commercial breaks?
Well, we start singing 50s music together. And we start talking nonsense and things like this. So quite frankly, just be glad that the mic was off and you were spared all of that.
Because tell them what song we were singing.
We're singing Who Put the Bomb in the Bomb to Bomb to Bomb, right?
Barry Mann, that's absolutely right. It's an oldie but a goodie. We're going to have to sing another doo-wop song here after this segment because it doesn't get any better. Did anyone hear what happened up in Connecticut this week? I'm sure you have. I'm sure you have if you're a regular listener to this show. Let me say that. If you're not a regular listener of this show, there's no way you had because the mainstream media
is trying to bury this.
That's right, because the man who went on the killing spree up there at the beer distributorship, it was a black. All eight of his victims were white. Now, could you imagine, Keith, if you had a white gunman that shot and only shot eight black people, how that would come across in the mainstream media? You'd probably had heard about it somewhere other than shows like this. But the story is a black man, Omar Thornton, got caught on video stealing from his employer.
Stealing beer.
And so he went and shot and killed eight people earlier this week at the beer distributorship where he worked. Before he shot himself, he spoke to his mother on a cell phone telling her, quote, "I killed the five racists that were bothering me." Now, as we all know, and he actually went on to kill eight. As we all know, a racist is the absolute worst person a thing can be, worse than a child molester, a rapist, or a murderer. A racist deserved to be shot down in cold blood. Now, what's interesting is that Omar Thornton was always complaining about racism to the white woman that he lived with and her mother, who he alleges once called him a racial epithet. The only thing is, the bosses at his work say he never filed a single complaint about racist treatment that he received from his fellow employees. No, he simply got caught stealing, knew that he was going to be fired, and decided if he was going to go down, he's going to take a bunch of racists with him. And, of course, we know that racist simply means white person in today's vernacular. If only, though, Keith, a Tea Partier could have gotten to him and explained that the Democrats are the real racists. I think that would have been beneficial.
Yeah, I think probably he could have dispensed with his job at the beer distributorship and traveled the country going from one Tea Party event to another as their token black conservative.
But in all seriousness, this is a very serious, that's probably not too far from the truth, unfortunately, but this is a very serious, obviously a grave matter here, life and death. Another black man goes ape. shoots eight people that he claims are racists, even though...
And it's their fault. Basically what the mainstream media is doing. They're laying it between the lines that, of course, this is understandable because racism is so pervasive in America, and black people are, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, sick and tired of being sick and tired. And these racists, these white racists that are trolling all through American society, irritating, enraging black people with their racism, you know, we've got to have some relief from them. Well, here's what happened, okay? This gentleman, Omar Thornton, the black guy that murdered eight people in cold blood, just happened to be having a meeting where he was represented by a Teamsters Union official. He was in the Teamsters Union. And management. Well, management had the goods on him. Here was a videotape showing him loading up coolers and putting them in his vehicle, apparently, full of beer, the product that is sold at the dealership, I mean at the distributorship. So they were going to give him the break of resigning so that he would have not this, and weren't going to prosecute him. In other words, they were cutting him a deal. They were giving him a break, probably because of the intervention of the Teamsters Union. Instead, he pulls out the gun, shoots eight people, kills eight people, and then gets on the phone, calls 911 before he kills himself, so he can have it established that he was doing this because he had been pushed to the edge by this inherent racism at this place. Well, there's a little bit of a problem with that. The dealership is owned by one Hollander family. They not only own the dealership, and they weren't racist, but they're reflexive racial liberals, typical left-wing do-gooders. They support all the local left-wing charities, buy tables at the local NAACP banquet. And not only that, they go above and beyond. They fund a lawsuit against the local school board to make them pay more money to the mostly from white property owner taxpayers to fund a school system that is 94% black in that town. And right now, Bloomfield pays over $18 million per pupil at the public schools, which is over $5,000 or about $5,000 more than the state average in Connecticut. And white people have to send their kids to private schools because these schools are so bad. This is the great racist that apparently Mr. Thornton was reacting to. And, you know, that just shows you that white people, like the people in the Tea Party, need to get over it. They need to wake up and smell the coffee. You know, in the final analysis, you're not going to be judged about whether or not you're a liberal or a conservative. You're going to be in the left to the tender mercies of somebody like Omar Thornton, and all he's going to see is whether you're black or white, and if you're white, you're toast, just like his victims. So people need to wake up, develop a sense of racial solidarity, and stop taking all of this punishment, which is not justified in the least. This, you know, in other words, great racist that he was responding to is a big liberal who made sure that blacks, that this majority black, 94% black school district got $5,000 per pupil more than the state average in Connecticut. Now, if that's a racist, tell me who is, you know, a supporter of black people.
Well, of course, Keith, you know, it makes sense in, on one hand, if you look at it in the context that the modern day definition of racism is anything that a white person does that a liberal, anything a white person does that a liberal doesn't like, a black doesn't like, then the modern day definition of racist is simply a white person. So even liberals are now capable of being racist under the modern definition, according to my book.
And they're being charged with it more and more. Even Keith Olbermann and Chris Matthews have recently been charged with being racist. Now, what's the upshot? What is the big picture for all of these charges of racism? Well, they're like seeds. You spread enough seeds out there, some of them are going to sprout and bear fruit. You know, the Jewish community, commenting on the rise of Nazism and the concentration camps, gas chambers, ovens, and all of that, they said that all that was very predictable because in Germany, before the Nazis, there was this pervasive anti-Jewish sentiment going around that was expressed, you know, openly by people in academia and whatnot. Well, they're doing the same thing to white people. This anti-white racism is going around, and it is beginning to sprout and bear fruit, just like this incident where 8 innocent people are killed because a black guy was caught stealing and he didn't want to lose his job.
Well, from there, Keith, we're going to go to an equally disturbing news piece. This one out of Sarasota, Florida. A man shot directly in the chest for carrying a Confederate flag. That story next after the break here on the Political Cesspool radio program. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
As our board operator, Denny, can attest, Keith and I had to do a couple of songs during that last segment, the content of the show, so...
I'm worn out.
We did a little Mac the Knife, we did Teenager in Love, Dion...
And I reminded him that Dion also did Abraham, Martin, and John.
Yeah, but he was very sorry about that, I'm sure. At least he should have been. But I remember Dion for all the good songs. Donna the Prima Donna, Lovers Who Wander, yeah. Teenager in Love, of course, Run Around Sue, The Wanderer, you know, all that good stuff. You know, give him a break. He made a mistake that
last
time.
Yeah, he was desperate to have another hit song.
Yeah, he had to get in that
he
old
He polluted the airwaves with
that's
that.
That's right.
Abraham, Martin, John song.
I overlooked that when I think of Dion. All right, well, in the last segment... Kind of hard to speak of this issue after talking about something so fun and upbeat, but we were talking, of course, about the, I guess now you'd be considered, what, a serial killer, Keith? Are you does 8 constitute serial? Or?
Yeah, I think it does, but of course, that serial killer and this guy and this incident will never be linked. This will be a freedom fighter, the modern Nat Turner, fighting for freedom for his people.
We were talking, of course, the... bloody incident involving Omar Thornton, the black worker at the beer distributorship in Connecticut. He killed 8 of his racist, a.k.a. white, co-workers because he was they were so racist to him, even though he had never filed a single complaint about racist treatment at work. The real reason, of course, he got caught stealing beer, and rather than go down, he was going to take a few with him. Now, equally disturbing, a story out of the Confederate state of Florida, Sarasota. A black man shoots a white man for waving a Confederate flag and gets only 10 years in prison. Now, of course, had the white guy shot the black man for wearing a Malcolm X shirt, he would have been executed.
It would have been the old Sparky for him, that's for sure.
Well, the story out of Sarasota, and listen to how they build up this black thug, this, you know, obviously a man, in this case, fortunately, unlike any of the victims in Connecticut, this white gentleman in Florida survived, but this is how the story reads. A former Sarasota Military Academy student, that being the black guy, of course, they had to put that in there. Now, if it was talking about me, it'd be, you know, the vile, racist, anti-Semite, blah, 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 James Edwards. But no, this guy who pulled a gun and shot a man in cold blood, he's the former Military Academy honor student. He had been sentenced to 10 years in prison, the story goes, for shooting a teenager who taunted him by waving a Confederate flag. Michael Mitchell has pleaded no contest to aggravated battery in the shooting of a teen outside of a downtown movie theater.
Not just Michael Mitchell now, Michael Jordan Mitchell.
Yeah, that's his middle name, Michael Jordan Mitchell. Daniel Azef, now 19, waved a Confederate flag from the back of his vehicle as he drove down Main Street, leading to a confrontation with Mitchell. Azef and a friend yelled racially disparaging comments, according to the story, and continued to wave the flag as they parked. 2 teenage girls were with Michael Jordan Mitchell as they asked him to walk away, but he just couldn't do it, and he went over and shot the white guy in the chest with a .22 caliber pistol before running off. Now, coming to my commentary on this matter, notice that the authorities claim that the white guy taunted the shooter and made racially disparaging remarks, as if that somehow justifies attempted murder. But Other witnesses claim that the victim, the white guy holding the Confederate flag, didn't say anything at all to the black guy, that the shooter, Michael Jordan Mitchell, the honor student, just started the argument on his own accord because he didn't like the Confederate flag. Now, judging from things I've seen in my own time, Keith, I believe that that story is far more believable than that which was printed in the Sarasota newspaper. But the bottom line is this. The black guy shoots the white guy in the chest. He gets 10 years in prison. Thankfully, the white guy with the Confederate flag lived. But just like the issue in Connecticut, had the roles been reversed and the black people been the victims rather than the aggressors, this would be a talking point at every water cooler across the country. But Keith, we've seen issues like this ourselves with a reporter here to do a story on us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've lived this one. We had a reporter from Die Zeit, which is a national German newspaper, apparently a big deal over in Germany. He came over to interview us, and we, of course, showed him a good time, took him out to breakfast. Then we went down to show him the Confederate parks because he wanted to know about James's episode involving protecting the Confederate parks from having their names changed, which was one of the things that basically kicked off the program, the political cesspool.
Back in 2005.
Well, when we went there, lo and behold, there are two white guys who show up and want to raise a Confederate flag at Confederate Park. You know, how strange that would be to have a Confederate flag flying at Confederate Park over Jefferson Davis's statue. Well, when these two guys arrive and try to do this, there are a lot of black bums and layabouts in the park drinking on 40-ounce beverages.
This is a true story, no exaggeration.
And one of them apparently was a big civil rights advocate. So he shows up and starts cursing up a blue streak, threatening with physical violence these guys. And these guys say, hey, it's just a flag. We want to fly this. And this guy said if he did, he was going to beat them up. He said they better back off or he wasn't responsible. And then he apparently got a group of other people to do this. The reporter from Die Zeit was flabbergasted. He was expecting to see a story about white racism against black people, and said he saw a story unfolding before his eyes of black racism against white people and an expression of their heritage and their ancestry. And as a result, no article appeared in Die Zeit about the political cesspool, because the only thing to be reported honestly was that the white people are the victims, and that the power structure that causes people to bend to its will in America now is a liberal, pro-black power structure.
Well, Keith is telling you the truth, and all of that unfolded. It couldn't have unfolded any better for this guy to see, had it been scripted, and it all unfolded within 30 seconds. Now, the two white guys with the Confederate flag, they may have wanted to raise it. There was no flagpole there. They were, at the time, simply walking around with it, which is their right. They hadn't found it yet. But nevertheless, they weren't doing anything wrong, certainly weren't breaking any laws, and then they get threatened with physical violence. And this is typical, and it's something that we've lived through. And he's lucky that the violence didn't escalate. I mean, because, yeah,
of course, if he'd been shot like this guy in Sarasota, well, of course, that's just what he should expect and deserve. And justice has been served, at least in the eyes of the mainstream media in the United States today.
And this reporter, who was one of the biggest reporters for the Washington Bureau of Die Zeit newspaper, which is the Times in Germany, he was backpedaling. I mean, he was walking backwards, getting behind me and Keith and Bill Rowland for protection. I mean, he really thought that there was going to be some damage done.
And he also had to admit to us that the aggressor and the bigot involved in this episode was the black man and not these two white guys.
Well, that being said, Keith, moving right along, shifting gears here mid-segment, you wanted to provide continuing commentary on an issue you raised last week during the show about the car dealership closures that were shut down, the white car dealerships that were shut down by the Obama administration and the myth of white privilege. What further can you tell us about that?
Okay, well, just to bring you back to where we were last week, we now have confirmation through no less an authority than Neil Barofsky, who is one of Obama's automobile car dealership czars, that the car dealerships for General Motors and Chrysler that were closed last fall when the government took over GM and Chrysler were invariably run by white males. No black-owned dealerships, no female-owned dealerships, no other minority group dealerships had a glove laid on them. And this shows you, if nothing else, that all of this talk that we hear incessantly from people like Tim Wise from the Southern Poverty Law Center about the existence of this kind of invisible prejudice called white privilege is a bunch of baloney. White privilege, my rear end. What you have in America with white people being penalized, being persecuted, being oppressed by our government. Just think of what would happen if a white Republican president had taken over these car dealers, these car companies, and started selectively terminating the dealerships of all the minorities. I mean, it would be like World War III. World War III would look like child's play compared to what would happen in the mainstream media if that happened. But on this, it takes a group like the American Thinker, a website, to bring this out. The silence is deafening from the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, and all the usual suspects, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN. It's all, you know, buried because they don't want that information getting loose.
Well, we're going to let that information loose and more when we return right after this commercial break. You're in the Political Cesspool with James Edwards and Keith Alexander.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Right before that last break, Keith was mid-stride in a commentary about the myth of white privilege. Continuing on some of the themes we touched on last week, I'm going to turn it back over to Keith and allow him to pontificate a little bit more. But first, I want to remind you to visit our website and support our radio program. ThePoliticalCesspool.org is the URL for our official internet headquarters. And coming up in just a minute, after this segment, in fact, as we go into the top of the second hour tonight, we'll be joined by Hutton Gibson, making his second appearance on our award-winning show. So we're very excited about that. Bill Rowland will be in studio to co-host with me as we interview Hutton Gibson. So, Keith, that being said, the mic is once again all yours.
Well, let's just get back to this car dealership closure situation in which one of the members of the Obama administration, one of his czars, a Neil Barofsky, has said that one of the rationales for closing these dealerships was which ones were owned by whites, particularly whites in rural red state America. Well, if this doesn't give the lie to the notion of white privilege, then I don't know what it's going to take. Tim Wise and a lot of other Jewish leftists have made a career out of going through the country and pontificating to young, impressionable white students who typically get some type of class credit, either in high school or college, for their attendance, to hear all about how white people still rule the world and how being white is such a tremendous advantage for people, and that black people, Hispanic people, women, gays, whatever, they just are, you know, they get the crumbs from the from America's table because of white privilege. When actually what this car dealership news item shows is that whites, far from getting privileged, they're the last served. We're the only people that are basically the victims of affirmative action. We don't get into Harvard and Yale. White Gentiles don't. We don't get job promotions. We don't, you know, it affects everybody from firemen to people, you know, in the upper echelons of the IQ spectrum that are trying to get into Harvard and Yale law school. this is what we have to deal with. So, and, you know, don't expect Tim Wise or people of his ilk, now that things have been shown for what they are, that basically there's no white privilege, it's white penalty now, don't expect them to change gears and suddenly start giving seminars about black or minority privilege or female gender privilege. They're not about to do this, because the dirty little secret is none of this was ever about fairness. What it was about is destroying whites and their prospects in society. It's just exactly what John C. Calhoun said. He said that the true game aim of the abolitionists was not freedom for the black race, but rather that the black race and white race change places in society. Now, this is what everybody is dealing with. And quite frankly, I was listening to Glenn Beck this week.
Oh, Keith, don't. You're not supposed to admit that publicly.
I know, but it was too good to pass up. What he was doing, he was talking about Dreams of My Father. You know, that was the name of Obama's famous book that was touted, but apparently nobody read before his election, because if they had read it, they would have realized that the dreams of his father were that not only America, but the world would be dominated by a communist government. His father was a full-blown communist, and he, you know, was to his dying day. In fact, that's why, you know, he basically got frozen out of the Kenyan government, because Jomo Kenyatta was kind of a third-way guy, not capitalist or communist, and Obama's father hewed closely to the communist line. Furthermore, Obama's grandfather was working for the British Army when he attacked some British soldiers and basically got kicked out, again, because of his anti-white outlook. So the dreams of Obama's fathers were racist and socialistic. What about the dreams of our fathers? Our fathers looked at America, turned a wild wilderness into the most productive and the wealthiest nation in the world, and now we're in the process of giving it away because we've fallen under the spell of liberalism. Now, see, this is a self-inflicted wound, and all that we need is for people to wake up, have the light bulb turn on over their head, and come to their senses, because basically, as you can see from this car dealership episode that we mentioned in the last segment, what's happening in America is that whites are being displaced. This beer distributorship incident where eight whites were gunned down by a black guy who was upset because he's going to get fired for being caught on videotape stealing cases of beer, what that shows you is that we're in for a rough time. If all these demographic changes that are being predicted by government census officials and others that whites are going to be a minority in America maybe as early as 2042 and at the latest by 2050, when we are no longer the numerical majority, we can't expect fair treatment. We're going to receive the same type of partisan persecution that we're seeing in things like the car dealership closures. This is what the future has in store for us unless we wake up out of this trance and start, you know, fighting for our rights and standing up for ourselves and our kind, James.
Well, Keith, you know, the dreams of Obama's father could very well be the dreams of Glenn Beck if you take him at his word when he says Martin Luther King, a.k.a. Michael King, was one of his, you know, all-time heroes. So I don't know what Beck's up to.
Well, the problem with Beck is the problem that a lot of people in blue state America have. Beck is from blue state America. He's from, what, Oregon or Washington or something like that. He has never had to deal with a sizable black population in his midst. So consequently, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, my father, who is from the South, moved to Minnesota. And that's where I was born. And when you're in Minnesota, he said that in the county that I lived in, that I was born in, there was one black person, not two, but one in the entire county. But that didn't stop all the people in there, up there in that particular county in Minnesota, from being instinctive experts on race relations who would scold him about how badly Southern whites treated blacks. Of course, it, as my father said, that was like somebody that lives in the desert presuming to tell somebody who lives in the jungle all about the jungle. See, this is the problem, and furthermore, it's compounded by the fact that because of the long march through the institution that the cultural Marxist left has made through the schools, through the entertainment industry, through the news media, through the churches, and just about every other institution that sets moral and ethical values that you can think of, these people that have grown up are waking up. And they have, you know, this is the problem with the Tea Party. These people in the Tea Party have conservative instincts, but they don't know what to do with it because they've ingested so much liberalism that they can't find the path. They can't find the right way. You know, how do people get that way? Alex Jones this week made a comment that I thought was very good. He was asking, how do all these smart kids, white Gentile kids, there aren't that many of them, but the ones that do make it to places like Harvard and Yale, how do they always get converted to being good card-carrying liberals? Well, his comment was this. He was quoting Albert Speer, who wrote his memoirs of the Third Reich, who was a Nazi but apparently got a pass for being a Nazi from the British. They asked him, how did all these good people get to be Nazis? He said, well, when the devil puts his hand on your shoulder and tells you how much he likes you and how much he admires you and how much he's going to do for you and how he's going to promote your career, it says you don't recognize him as the devil. This is what's happening throughout America. People better wake up and identify the enemy. We at the paleoconservative political cesspool are under no illusions about who the enemy is. The enemy is liberalism. Liberalism is how that's the wedge, that is the strategy, that is the tactic used by the left to take over America. And they have, there's a leadership, and then we have a useful idiot cadre of minorities and white Gentiles that are basically the ones who are, you know, the amen corner of the whole movement. But if you embrace liberalism, you're basically in a suicide pact because, you know, when it gets right down to it, you know, you're the target, and they're not going to listen. You're not going to be heard when you protest with your dying breath that you are a liberal and not a conservative. That's not the way it works, folks, as the people at the beer distributorship in Connecticut found out.
Well, that's all the time, ladies and gentlemen, we have for this first hour. Keith Alexander doing a bang-up job, as always. He might be leaving us until next week, but this show will roar on as we head into the second hour and then some. Coming up next, Hutton Gibson on deck. Don't go anywhere.
1 hour down and two to go. Stay tuned. Hour number two of The Political Cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and said, something's got a hold on me. The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his Fruit of the Looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the A.